Da han hørte hvilke ord som kom ut av munnen hennes, hoppet hjertet hans over et slag, og et sug i magen fikk han til å legge ned McFrysen han var på vei til å spise. For han så på henne at hun mente det hun sa. Men han spurte likevel om hun var sikker, og hun nikket unnskyldende. Men egentlig så hun ikke trist ut i det hele tatt, men letta. Og da hun nikket av restauranten, tenkte han på hva han skulle ønske han hadde sagt. Og det er sånne ting som gjør at folk sitter her og gråter noen ganger. Men sånn er livet. Og McDonald's er bare en liten del av det, tross alt.
That record, that first Iron Maiden record, changed my life from the moment I picked it up. Because that was really, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm made for.
Gammel Maiden.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Ah, it's so nice to hear your voice. It's loud and clear.
All right, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Hør på det her. Du hører allerede her at jeg kjempenervøs. Det jo bare så vidt at jeg klarer å snakke på den ganske så rustne trønder-englishen min. Men mest av alt så jeg jo glad, så klart. Utrolig glad for å være i gang med min første transatlantiske episode av Gammel Maiden. Og glad for at en felles interesse for Maiden, et av tidenes råeste metalband, har følt meg til CJ, som spilt bass i Ramones den siste tida, siste ni årene fram til 1996. Og for meg så er det lite mirakel egentlig i denne pandemiskiten vi lever oppi nå, å få sett og høre musikk i lag med en kar på andre siden av kloden, som har de beste historiene fra turnélivet med Ramones, og ikke minst da audition med Ramones, der han måtte legge Steve Harris teknikkene sine på hylla og prøve å spille med plekter for første gang. Så scream for me, San Francisco. Her er CJ Ramone.
Gammel Maiden med Torkel Torsvik.
CJ Ramone, welcome to Gammel Maiden.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Where do you live, CJ?
I live in the East Bay of San Francisco.
Ah, oh, beautiful area.
Yeah. Weather's real nice right now, too.
Yeah, I've been there once, so...
okay, all right.
But it was really beautiful. This is crazy because we have a common friend that told me that CJ Ramone, he's a fan of Iron Maiden, and suddenly we're talking. You have to excuse my bad English, but...
okay.
But how are you, CJ?
Doing good. I'm doing good. I've actually used this whole lockdown situation to my advantage. I've actually spent some time taking care of my health and losing some weight and spending time with my family. So even though it's a bad, you know, it's kind of a bad situation for everybody and especially for anybody in the music industry, yeah. I've tried to keep it as positive as I can.
I heard a lot of people do like you, like use this time to spend more time with their family because I guess you're still touring when there's not a pandemic going.
Well, 2019, I actually announced that I was not going to tour anymore. I do still go out and play with a band called the Gimme Gimmes, which is a bunch of other guys from other bands, and we get together and do covers from all different time periods, from the 50s all the way through the 70s disco era and 80s pop, but we do it total punk rock style. So yeah. It's actually really fun. So I'm still doing that, but as far as touring, I had, in 2019, it was 30 years for me on the road. So when the pandemic first hit, there in early 2020, I had planned on taking that year off anyway.
Ah, okay.
So it was, you know, I couldn't have planned it any better. So so I was prepared and I jumped right into, like I said, taking care of myself. I lost a bunch of weight. I stopped drinking. I started eating better. Just get myself healthy. But after this, with people not having live music for so long, I almost feel like I kind of owe it to everybody to get back on the road when this is over with and get out and see everyone again and do some music. So you never know, you know, musicians always have a hard time retiring.
Let's start this as I do in every episode. I have this this really nice question, I think. Do you remember the first time you heard an Iron Maiden song?
So Iron Maiden is the first band that I ever found on my own and started listening to. Like, nobody said, hey, check this band out, or I didn't hear them on the radio or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Where I grew up in Long Island, New York, a little town called Deer Park, there was a store across from the school that I went to called the Sweet Palace. And it was a record store, video games, food and candy and stuff like that. It was just for kids.
Yeah.
And I walked in one day, and in the record bin was the first Iron Maiden record. I'm guessing this is probably somewhere around maybe, I want to say, September, October maybe of 1980.
Wow.
And, you know, growing up as a kid, I loved comic books. I loved horror films. Anything having to do with it, I was immediately drawn to. So when I saw that album cover, I was like, oh my God, I have to buy this, you know? So, I spent probably 2 or 3 days lunch money on, I bought the record. I got it home. And I had a crappy little record player, and I opened it up and I put it on, and just that opening guitar riff on Prowler, yeah. I got like pins and needles immediately. Like I actually felt like pins and needles, and I sat there completely mesmerized, flipped the record over, listened to the other side. I must have listened to that record probably 6 or 7 times in a row before my dad knocked on the door and was like, lower that shit. So that was the beginning that record is kind of the beginning of me finding my own identity.
Yeah.
And becoming, really starting to become a really good bass player. Like, Geezer Butler from Black Sabbath is the guy that made me want to play bass.
Mm-hmm.
Black Sabbath was the first band I ever heard that made me move away from the stuff that I grew up with. So the stuff that my mom and dad turned me on to, or, you know, stuff I heard on the radio. Black Sabbath is the band that made me kind of move away from everything I had heard before.
Yeah.
Iron Maiden, Steve Harris, is the guy that made me just completely forget about everything else and only want to play bass.
Okay. Wow.
That record, that first Iron Maiden record, changed my life from the moment I picked it up, because that was really my, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm made for. This is absolutely it. And of course, Iron Maiden did not come I didn't actually get to see them until 1982.
Okay.
I think it was 82 I saw them the first time at the...
with Bruce Dickinson, maybe.
It would have to be. Would have to be Dickinson. Yeah, at the Palladium in New York City.
Okay.
And then again, I saw them, I saw them so many times after that, but to me, I've always said, since I got into the Ramones and people asking my influence, I always said I was a total metal guy. I was totally into heavy metal. There were no punk rock bands where I lived. I loved punk rock. I listened to punk rock. I loved the Ramones. I worshiped the Ramones and Dee Dee. I loved the Ramones, but I played strictly in metal bands. There were no punk bands. And the thing that I kind of dug about Maiden was they weren't punk, but they kind of had this like just real street feel to them.
Yeah.
And even though the, you know, lyrically, you could already tell the lyrics were more intelligent than a lot of the other kind of, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll kind of thing. And and I was really drawn to that because I grew up, I loved literature. I loved poetry. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't just a beer drinking dum-dum, you know, like I loved all of that stuff and horror movies and comic books. And they just encompassed all the parts of youth culture that I loved. Mm-hmm. It was just... like it's one of those things, you know, everyone has that that moment in the, you know, when they're young where they you can almost feel yourself separating from your childhood. You know, you're like you're taking a step into like this next part of your life, and that was Iron Maiden was the band that I stepped into that next part of my life with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so nice. I'm sitting here in Norway. It's 6 o'clock in the evening, and you just got up, I think. It's early in the morning. Oh,
I've been up for hours.
Okay, so you're one of those guys.
But yes.
But I had the exact same experience only 10 years later in 1990, I think. And okay. It's so nice to sit here,
yeah.
Speak with CJ Ramone. And we got this one thing in common, discovering this band. And did you have your own money to buy the records and to go to concerts and stuff? How do you
yeah.
get
that? Yeah, so when I was younger, I started working when I was pretty young. There was just, you know, there was too much stuff that I wanted to do and see, and you know, I wanted gear. I wanted a good bass amp. I wanted a nice bass. You know that. So I was always motivated to try to get out and make money.
Mm-hmm.
And I did everything you can imagine from, you know, mowing people's lawns to working in a chemical factory to, you know, working, you know, putting together little electronic parts. And I did every crappy little blue collar job anyone could ever imagine.
And how old were you in this time?
So that's as soon as I was old enough to work, which is 15 or 16 years old in the States. But even before that, you know, paper route, delivering newspapers, whatever I could do to make a couple of dollars to, you know, grow my record collection or, you know, be able to buy another set of strings for my bass. You know, I couldn't afford strings was the last thing I worried about. So I'd have the same strings on my bass for a year, you know, so anytime, anything I could do to make a couple of dollars, I used to get out and try to do. And because of it, you know, I always had like a really good vinyl collection. And I would never spend money on a really good stereo, though. I didn't care. You know what I mean? But I always had a good vinyl collection. I still do. I still have a lot of good pieces of vinyl left.
Yeah. Well, every guest in my podcast can pick one song from the Maiden catalog. And which one do you pick?
So my favorite, absolute favorite Maiden song, and I don't even have to give it any thought, is Prodigal Son.
Okay.
Then I've always had...
I will try to play some of the music. Do you hear this?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, love it.
So nice.
Oh, yeah. Really unique for them, too. It's
yeah.
They didn't write too many songs in this style.
Oh, I know. I can only give you some snippets from the songs because of some...
Yeah.
Of course. ...rights, but... why Prodigal Son then? Because it's really like a special, unique Maiden song.
Yeah. So I'm not, I love the two albums with Deano. I really love them. And it has a lot to do with the fact of the age I was when I heard them. And like for all the reasons I said before about how it just made me feel and everything else. But When I grew up, I went to Catholic school. I was in a Catholic school. The area where we lived when I was very young was a very rough area. Mm-hmm. And my dad realized that I might fall into bad habits if I continued in that area. So he put me into a Catholic school. It was a very odd thing for me because most people that listen to this type of music, just don't, the two things don't overlap all that much, I guess, at least back then. But I grew up, pretty Catholic. That's just the culture I grew up in. Mm-hmm. So when I heard, when Iron Maiden, had a song called Prodigal Son, which is one of, the parables from the Bible, I immediately was drawn to it. But on top of it, it's the whole feel of the song, that acoustic in the beginning and the lyrics were so intriguing to me. I was like, who is Lamia? And I knew Lamia from, Greek mythology and stuff. Like, I knew the term, the word, but mm-hmm. I didn't know who Lamia was. And the more I read the lyrics and tried to decipher them and figure out what they were, the less I understood it. And it just made me more intrigued. So the song it's kind of like this just weird little piece of Iron Maiden that, I can't explain, I can't explain it. So I it just stuck with me all these years. And as much as I love everything heavy, I really love Iron Maiden style in general. But as they went on, they seemed to have kind of boiled down their style to like specific things. And then all their songs kind of followed that kind of same formula.
Yeah.
Whereas in the beginning, they were a little bit more experimental, right? Strange World or Remember Tomorrow. They're just like odd little songs that are...
yeah.
It's almost like a cross between like heavy metal and Pink Floyd. Yeah. It's this really... textural, I love the mix of stuff on those types of songs. But over the years, they kind of moved away from that. They as they got heavier. But the cool thing is they still included some of that atmospheric kind of stuff, like in that's a good Still Life.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Still Life off of Peace of Mind, right? Yeah. It's very moody and dark and like simmering and intense, it's like the difference between like The Exorcist and Poltergeist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's The Exorcist is scary as heck for a lot of stuff that you don't see. Whereas Poltergeist is just like, bam, smash you in the face with crazy special effects and everything else. but it's those early records, they were a little bit more experimental. They allowed themselves to kind of, drift a little bit, be so focused. That change in style really kind of sunk in when Nico McBrain came into the band.
Okay.
Clive Burr, one of my favorite drummers of all time. I mean, incredibly underrated. I even, after the Ramones retired, I tried to contact Clive Burr to see if we could start a band together. I literally did, through the Ramones, I had some connections and I asked, I spent a lot of time making phone calls and just asking, people like, hey, do you have any connection at all to Clive Burr? I was never able to hunt him down, but I really like, I was like, I want to start a band with him. You know what I mean? His drumming, his style, really just, I'm, as much as, you know, I love Steve Harris, you know, definitely my top three favorite bass players of all time, I always felt like Clive Burr was kind of the driving force behind those early Maiden records. Genghis Khan or, you know what I mean?
Oh my God,
like his
I love
drumming.
It.
His drumming is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It really is. It's like, and he was a single bass drum player. So all that stuff you hear, that's 1 foot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he really, I just really think like him and Steve Harris were just so, they almost were like, I guess probably because they, you know, in those early years when you're real excited and there's very little distraction and it's just all about the music and getting together and playing and everything else before, you know, tour schedules and managers and, you know, interviews and all that stuff comes along in the beginning, you really like locking in, and they just were so good together. They were so good together.
Did you reach him? So did you get to speak with him?
I was never able to get in contact with him.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
I would love to hear that band, CJ Ramone and Clive Burr.
Oh, forget it. Because, you know, originally, I'm a finger player. I always played with my fingers before the Ramones. I never played with a pick before.
Yeah, I never read that. But when did you learn how to play with like down picking?
After I went to my first audition with the Ramones.
After your first?
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, I knew the band was looking for like a DD guy, you know. So I bought some picks the day I went down to the first audition and just kind of muscled my way through it. I had no idea, no clue, and
shit.
You know, I had played acoustic guitar with a pick and everything, but playing bass with a pick, I think I might have experimented with it in like the, you know, probably in like the mid 80s or something. I probably experimented with playing with a pick a little bit, but I was just, you know, impatient and I didn't want to learn how to do something that I really didn't have to learn how to do. And I played like Steve Harris. I only used 2 fingers on my right hand.
Okay.
I only play with 2 fingers. So I had Steve Harris's style down so hard that I would, on weekends, I would play with 3 different bands in different clubs. I would drive from one club to the other because, you know, back then, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, the Scorpions, all that stuff was really big, and all the cover bands were playing that.
Yeah.
So when I was only 16 when I first started playing in clubs, I had guys that were a lot older than me that were started coming around and being like, hey, come and play with us. Hey, come and play with us. And I ended up playing, you know, in a bunch of different bands and doing Iron Maiden covers. And I could play anything. I could play any song by Iron Maiden all the way up to Power Slave. I could play any song, note for note, riff for riff. I could do it all. And
wow.
So usually, like my thing was, I'd go into an audition and the guys would be like, all right, so play us something. And I'd go into Phantom of the Opera. I'd play like maybe like the first quarter of Phantom of the Opera, and they'd be like, okay, you got it.
So you played with your fingers on in the audition?
Yeah, no. I went to the first audition I brought picks.
Okay.
But after the first audition, I had to really start learning how to use a pick.
I guess your muscles was really...
Well, this is the thing. In the beginning, I thought, yeah, I can just muscle through this. But the Ramones do all down picking. They don't do alternate picking.
Yeah.
It's all down picking. So you can't muscle through songs at that tempo for 35 songs in a row in an hour and 15 minutes. And I learned that really fast. So I developed a technique. And what I did was I realized the lower I put my bass and extended my arm, once my arm was hanging straight, I only played with my wrist.
Oh.
And so the muscles in my arm wouldn't cramp up. So that's why when you see pictures, my bass is hanging down by my knee. Because when your arm is straight, you take your elbow out of it, you stop using your forearm, and you only use your wrist. And I developed that on my own. Nobody taught me that. Nobody showed me that. That was something I did. It was a matter of survival. Because after I had gone to, you know, two or three auditions, I realized, holy cow, I might get this gig. I better figure out how I'm going to play, you know, an hour and 15 minutes, you know, at that pace. And I sat down and I just started experimenting and I lowered my strap and I realized, wow, it got easier. So I lowered it a little more. And then once I had it all the way down to hitting my knee and my arm was straight, boom, that was it.
I guess a lot of people think you guys do that because it looks really cool, but it's technique.
Not for me. Not for me. It literally was a matter of survival in the Ramones. I had to find a way to do it, and that was, you know, that was the technique I developed. And now, you know, I when kids ask me, you know, how do you do it, I tell them, I'm like, this all just lower your bass down. It makes it a little bit harder on your left hand, like to reach notes and stuff like that sometimes. But with the Ramones, I'm just picking out root notes most of the time, so I don't have to be super virtuoso with my left hand. But that right hand's got to be able to pump.
Yeah, but I have also seen pictures of you with a, is it a Fender Precision? The same bass as Steve Harris, isn't it?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yep.
So you got a lot of in common with Steve Harris then.
Oh, forget it. I researched everything. You know, back then, there was no internet. There was no computers. Any information you found, you would have to read in an interview or something like that.
Look at pictures and stuff.
Right.
Magazines.
Exactly. Yep. So when I found out that he was using flat wound strings, I was amazed because his sound was so great. He had such a great sound, very bright, and it stood out. And of course, you know, they always had his bass lines pushed up in the mix because he is, you know, the founding member of the band. But when I found out he used flat wound strings, I couldn't believe it. I had been playing round wound because John Entwistle from The Who, I used to love, also one of my favorite bass players.
Yeah.
He used Roto Sound round wound strings, and that's always what I used. And then I heard Steve Harris Scott used round wound strings, but I realized he was also using, you know, the amplifier he was using was way better than what I had. You know, I think he was using different pickups, and I started to pick up on a lot of the stuff that he did. I never made the jump to round wound strings because I just couldn't get them to sound as good as he had them sounding. I experimented with them a little bit, but flat wound strings are they're tough. You really, really have to work your sound well to get the kind of sound that he does.
So did you find out how he makes these like poppy sounds when you listen to a Maiden song? Sometimes the bass comes through like pop, 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 some sounds like that. How does he do that?
I think it's a combination of the pickups he's using and the amplifier, of course. It has a lot to do with his gear, but it also has a lot to do with how he plays. He has his right hand. He's really a unique player. He really is. He's definitely one of the greats. I mean, I can't even say enough about the guy. His playing, his attack, and his technique with his right hand is just, it's very unique, and he's a master at it, masterful.
So did you get any like video footage so you could watch him and learn, or was it only pictures and listening?
Back then, the only video footage was MTV videos.
Yeah.
That was the only time. Or if you went to see them live. And of course, I saw them live many, many times.
Get as close as possible and watch his right hand.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, now it's great because you can pull up anything on YouTube and zoom in and, you know, watch, you know, watch where he's playing and watch his technique. And it's you can dissect it and copy it. But back then, it literally was, you know, you listen to it and you try to figure it out. You know, you try to figure out how he's doing it. Yeah. I never could do the three finger thing. There's guys that play bass and they use three fingers or even four fingers on their right hand. I could never get that down. So okay. I was playing with two fingers only on the right hand doing the gallop.
Yeah.
And so the first time I went to see them, I was close enough to watch, you know, watch closely. And I realized he was using two fingers and I was like, all right, good. Okay. I'm on the right track.
Because I watched Live After Death on VHS like 100 times. And I still thought that he was using four fingers.
Yeah. I mean, he may have like moved to it at some point, but I know early on he was playing with two fingers. When I went to see him.
Yeah.
And all those, you know, all that galloping that he does, that was all with two fingers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there are some songs that are just, you know, bass playing wise, like especially the epic songs, right? I call them their epics, you know, Phantom of the Opera, Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, you know.
My favorite.
Yeah. To Tame a Land. You know, those are like epic creations, you know, and in those songs, he always does those nice little melodic bass solo kind of parts, you know, where it's just bass and maybe drums and vocals. Guy is just unreal.
Yeah,
I know. He created such a unique style and nobody has been able to match it or copy it or, you know... Like, what bands can you listen to and go, oh, yeah, that sounds just like Iron Maiden? Nobody.
Never happened.
Yeah, nobody. Like, they are one of the bands. It's like, you know, Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, Motorhead, the Ramones. There are some bands that just, they're so unique. Nobody else can sound like them. Nobody else can do what they do. And it's a... It's a AC/DC, you know, it's a very small group of these bands that kind of came in with totally their own thing and the world just kind of caught up with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, Iron Maiden, you could say definitely belonged to the metal scene without a doubt. You know, it was Judas Priest and Iron Maiden, Priest and the Beast. I mean, that was like one of the greatest concerts I ever saw, Madison Square Garden. I think it was October 83 or something like that. But, you know, but even still, musically, Iron Maiden and Judas Priest were very different, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In my opinion, Judas Priest went for the, you know, well, early on, they were a little bit more like Iron Maiden in that they had more... more kind of technical drummers and even bass lines early on, Judas Priest. But then later on, they kind of boiled their style down to like just, you know, heavy riffs with good hooks in it and, you know, Rob Halford doing his thing. but Iron Maiden really kind of, to me anyway, stood out. You know, I love the Scorpions. I love UFO. I love all the bands from that era. I really do. I'm a huge fan of all of them. But nobody ever came close to Iron Maiden for me. Nobody. That was it. You know, they were the band. Black Sabbath will always be my favorite band of all time, without a doubt. But like I said, you know, learning to play and just kind of stepping away from everybody else and everything I knew before it and everything else, Iron Maiden's the band that I kind of stepped into.
Yeah, and Geezer Butler is, yeah, he's got a lot of common with Steve Harris. He writes lyrics, he writes songs, and he's got this huge plan. I guess that's a thing.
It's funny that they both had a vision of what their band was going to be. Yeah. They had like a vision of it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's so rare. Where, you know, a lot of bands just kind of find themselves by, you know, by happenstance, you know what I mean? Like a bunch of good musicians get together and they start playing like, you know, Led Zeppelin. I don't think Led Zeppelin really had like a global view of what they were going to look like and sound like and everything else. They just kind of dressed the part for their time period and, you know, played and wrote incredibly great songs, stuff nobody ever heard before. Whereas Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden, it's like they started out with this idea of how we can create, you know, music and imagery, and it's just there's so much forethought to it almost that it, you know, and like I said, if you were into horror films and comic books and, you know, stuff like that, Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden were like the greatest thing ever. Yeah. You know,
and here we are, like in 2021, with this science fiction technology,
a different century,
and we can listen to music together, me and you. And let's just hear this transition to the more faster pace.
Okay.
Clive Burr. Oh, that's
oh,
the man.
Man. Oh, God.
So nice. And, there's no other Maiden song with this kind of rhythm, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've toyed around with the idea of doing an acoustic version of that. I actually started trying to figure out how I could do that with just the acoustic and singing. And I'll probably get to it at some point and just throw it up on my Facebook page as a post for my followers and stuff. But the
you got some acoustics on your last the Holy Spell album from 2019.
Yep, that's kind of the thing that I really love about both Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden. That got lost in heavy metal over the years, and that, you know, they understood you can't just do everything one way. You know, you can't just be, every song can't be heavy. Every song can't be about, you know, nuclear destruction or the devil or you know what I mean? Like they understood, like, you have to have other stuff, you know, other things to say. And if it isn't something you feel strongly about, you have to have good influences. So that's what I always loved about both the bands. I mean, literature and poetry, and there's so much to their music, so much lyrically, there's so much to what they're doing.
Yeah.
And even later on, when Dickinson comes into the band, you know, Sunlight and Steel and, you know, Aces High and all these military-themed songs and stuff. I love history, you know. I absolutely love history. So I was so drawn to that stuff, you know. I immediately got pulled into it. It was, you know, Phantom of the Opera, you know. I know I mentioned that one a lot. It's one of my favorite songs. But, you know, I saw the movie when I was a kid. I knew about it, you know. And they almost take you, you know, they take you on these, the songs take you on these journeys through the stories. And I'm the type of person, if I listen to a song, I'm listening to the lyrics, I get like visual pictures in my head, you know. So as I'm listening to Phantom of the Opera, I'm seeing the movie. You know, or as I'm, you know, you listened to, you know, the Twilight Zone, right? The Twilight Zone was one of my favorite TV shows, So there was so much of what they wrote about and played, I just related to in a way that I never related to another band.
Yeah. And I remember listening to The Number of the Beast, and then I found this this text, and wow, it's from the Bible. And then I found it in my parents' Bible, and it was oh my God, this is huge.
I have to
dive deep in this all these lyrics, and it became a small religion.
And that's part of the magic of songwriting is when you can write a song and someone listens to it and they immediately feel a connection to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, look at a song like Invaders, right? And I must have read stories like that since I'm a young boy, reading stories about, you know, the invasions all over the world, and not just modern day, but, you know, history. And so immediately it's like, oh my God, I know what he's talking about. You know, music is such a cool thing. It's the way that you connect with people and the way that, you know, the way that you make people feel because of that connection by doing something that you love to do and putting all, you know, everything you have into it. And besides all the other nice stuff that comes along with it, you know, that is like such a really special part of music.
Yeah. And meeting up with your friends and showing them your new album with the cover, and you have to discover all the details that Derek Riggs drew.
Oh,
the covers, amazing. They are so beautiful.
Yep.
So how did you react when you saw like Eddie for the first time? Can you remember?
Oh, on stage? Oh, forget it. I mean, that's the unique thing about Iron Maiden too is nobody ever had the theatrics they had. I mean, Alice Cooper, you know what I mean? Alice Cooper definitely had a crazy theatrical show, but you know, other bands relied solely on lights and explosions and everything else.
Yeah,
but a couple years back, I don't even remember how long ago, I took my kids, my whole family, to go see Iron Maiden at Jones Beach Theater on Long Island.
Okay.
I can't remember what tour it was, but, you know, they had the huge screen where they showed all the different album covers. They were playing songs from just about from everything.
Yeah.
And they showed all the different album covers, and Eddie came out, and it was there was so much going on besides them and what they do on stage and the lights and everything else and the music. Just the image of Eddie, I mean, everyone who's, you can't look away from it. It's just it's just great. Yeah. It's realistically to me, Eddie has become, you know, Eddie's like an icon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anywhere you go in the world, I don't care if you're in India, China, you know, Japan, go anywhere in the world and ask, and you will find Iron Maiden fans.
Yeah.
And even people who don't know Iron Maiden will recognize Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that image has been plastered everywhere on the planet. You know, that just another really great decision, and really shows vision from Steve Harris to be able to make that connection. Like, yeah, that's what we want, you know, that's what we need.
CJ, we have to hear the voice of this fantastic singer, Paul Di'Anno. You ready?
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever played this song live.
Yeah, I don't think so. I've never heard a live recording of it.
No, and I don't think Bruce Dickinson could do this. Like, I think this chorus is so beautiful when he when Paul Di'Anno sings this.
I have a good story about Paul Di'Anno. A few years back, Paul Di'Anno spent a lot of time in Brazil. I believe he was married to a Brazilian gal for a while, or living with a Brazilian gal.
Okay.
And I had a connection to him through somebody that I was working with there. We were talking one day about Iron Maiden, and you know, I was just raving about Paul Di'Anno, and you know, I heard that he was in Brazil at the time, and I was trying to get her to come down because he had done a cover of Blitzkrieg Bop, and okay. I was trying to get him to come down and sing it with me and my band on stage. And I forget what was going on. He had something going on, and he wasn't able to come or anything.
Okay.
So I said to her, you know, let him know I can play any song that he ever did with Iron Maiden. And if he ever needs anybody to, you know, to go out on tour or whatever, to please consider me, you know, to, you know, tell him, I'll go out and tour with him anytime. I said it would really be like a very big thing for me to play with him.
Okay.
So she called me a little while after that and said, listen, Paul's actually considering doing like a small retirement tour over here in Brazil.
Okay.
And he wanted to know if you were interested in playing bass. And I was like, oh my God. So I told her, I said, you know, yeah, you know, anything I have going on, I'll cancel. You know, tell him to pick whatever dates he wants. I'll be there. But unfortunately, it did not happen. It didn't come to fruition.
And, what year was this?
This isn't too long ago. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit more, but it was definitely around that time, 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe a little bit more.
Oh, that would be really nice.
Yeah. Oh, forget it. Forget it. I would have done anything to have been able to do that. But it was nice that he actually, you know, reached out and considered me for it. You know, those two records, I know they said, you know, they let Paul Di'Anno go, or he left because he couldn't keep up with the schedule. You know, he was having trouble keeping up with the schedule.
Yeah.
And I think they said the same thing about Clive Burr.
Yeah.
But I understand that, because even within my own band, you know, I've had guys that are great players and love touring.
Mm-hmm.
But they came out on the road with me and they got burnt out really quick.
Yeah.
It takes a certain amount of discipline to be able, you know, to tour. It really does.
Yeah.
Because of course the drinks are free, you know, the girls are free, you know, the whole lifestyle on the road is very it's very open.
Yeah.
You're really only responsible for yourself for the hour or 2 hours that you stand on the stage. But the problem is, like, you don't decide when you eat. You don't even decide when you go to the bathroom. You know what I mean? Like, you're on the band schedule.
Yeah.
Han visste det ikke enda, men noen av de beste barndomsminnene han skulle ta med seg videre I livet var dagene hjemme syk fra skolen med bestefar som barnevakt. Ikke det at det var så innmari gøy å være syk, men han fikk bestille McNuggets til lunsj og se på TV I sofaen mens bestefar leste papiravisa ved siden av. Og det nettopp sånne dager som betyr mer enn det virker som der og da. For sånn livet. Og McDonald's bare en liten del av det, tross alt.
Right? So, you know, there's nights when you get back to the hotel at 3 or 4 in the morning and you got to be downstairs in the lobby at 7 or 8 to catch a flight to the next city. So what do? You don't go to sleep for 2 or 3 hours. You go to your room with a bunch of people and you crack a bottle of whiskey and, you know, And so what happens is, and what happens is it's easy to get caught up in that.
Yeah.
You get caught up in it. And some people don't, you know, they can't keep up with that. They can't do it all the time. I'm lucky enough, you know, I'm lucky enough that when I got into the Ramones were, you know, had rules, and I was expected to follow the rules, which I did for the most part. But when I was off the clock, I was off the clock.
Yeah.
And there's only one time my extracurricular activities really hurt the band, and that was we were in Montreal one time, and I drank excessively. And for a long period of time, it was probably like a good, you know, 10 hours of just pounding everything I could get my hands on.
Okay.
And I had alcohol poisoning, and I threw up on stage for the next 2 days. Like,
oh, shit.
At one point, I had to sit down on the drum riser and play. I was hurting so bad. But, you know, I made it through the shows, but I probably should have gone to the hospital and you know, had gotten an IV and gotten taken care of, but you can't, you know, I mean, there's shows to do, you know, you're on the band schedule, and if you do, you know, if you, you know, you can't make the band pay the price for your own stupid decision making. So you just got to tough it out. But I've seen more than a few people, you know, in better positions than I was in bigger bands than I was in, blow their gigs because they, you know, got caught up in drugs or alcohol, or they just couldn't deal with, you know, living on the road.
Yeah, and there's so much spare time. Nothing happens, and you just have to, take a drink or,
Not
like Bruce Dickinson, you go to the gym and do some fencing, you know. I don't think he could do the World Slavery Tour without his training, his physique.
Well, that's the thing with being a singer. You know, if you're a bass player, a guitar player, and your stomach muscles get weak, you know, because you don't do any exercise, and your lungs get weak because you smoke too much hash, it don't really matter.
Oh.
But if you're a singer, and you're responsible for entertaining the audience and singing, you know, you have to remain physically fit in order to do that.
Yeah.
You have to maintain, you know, good health to be able to get up there and do that. And how old is Dickinson now? He's got to be closing in on 60, right?
Yeah, I think...
Or he might be better than 60 at this point.
I think so. I'm not... But actually, I just thought of this guy that's Mark Evans, you know, the AC/DC bass player in the beginning. It's his birthday today, actually. He's 65.
All right.
And he quit the band because of the touring. He couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So,
AC/DC is another one of those bands. They're, you know, the legacy bands like Iron Maiden and like AC/DC.
Yeah.
They chew members up and spit them out.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? If you're not, you know, if you're not the kind of person that the road is your life, you don't last in those bands. But, you know, in his defense, how many years do you put in with a band? You know what I mean? Like, how long do you keep going before you go, okay, guys, I had enough. I'm gonna check out right here, you know?
Yeah.
It's... you know, I watched it happen with the Ramones, you know, Joey, when we did our final shows on Lollapalooza in 1996, there was a promoter in Argentina who offered the Ramones $1 million to come down and play two shows.
Wow.
And Joey, I came. I walked into the dressing room, and there was a lot of yelling going on.
Okay.
And between Mark and Johnny and Joey, and Joey came to me afterwards, and he was like, "CJ, if I turn down the offer in Argentina, would you be mad?" And I told him, "Joey, you gave him 22 years. If you don't want to go, don't go." And at the time, you know, nobody could have used that money more than me. You know, yeah. I was, you know, I could have definitely used $250,000 for sure, you know. but, you know, I knew Joey had been diagnosed with lymphoma in 1994. So yeah. I knew this 2 years later, he was really dragging himself through it. And I answered him as a friend, you know. I told yeah. him, 22 years, Joey, you did everything the band wanted you to do. If you don't want to go, don't go.
Wow.
Just don't. Just say no. And, of course, he turned it down. It was going to happen, you know, it was supposed to then be happen later on. But, of course, you know, Joey passed away before we were ever able to do a reunion tour. And once Joey was gone, then there was no more Ramon. So, so I understand what the, you know, I mean, AC/DC. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? Yeah, AC/DC was around in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're talking it's about crazy. A band that's been around since the 70s.
And Brian Johnson is the oldest guy of them all.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. He made the announcement I think, a year or two back where he said he was leaving. He was like, I just can't keep up with the tour schedule. But, you know, at the same time, I understand why these guys want to stay out on the road. You know,
yeah.
It's expensive. These bands have payrolls. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have, you know, they rent warehouses to store all their gear and their stage stuff. Iron Maiden owns a 757. You know what I mean? If you're not out on the road, if you're not on the road making money, because God knows you don't make money on record sales anymore. But if you're not out on the road touring, the bills don't get paid. Your nice lifestyle of, you know, a nice house and everything, you know, nice for your family and, you know, driving expensive sports cars and all that stuff. All that stuff goes away real quick if you take 2 years off.
Yeah.
Take 2 or 3 years off from touring and, you know, you don't know what it's going to be like when you come back. People have a short memory sometimes. Although I don't think Iron Maiden or AC/DC is, you know, in any danger of ever being forgotten about or people not coming to their shows, I think.
Oh.
You know,
but you started as a bass player in a band that you loved. You loved Dee Dee, and how was that to pick up the bass and do that job? Thinking of your background, you loved Dee Dee so much. How was it?
You know, I realized from the beginning, like Dee Dee Ramone is the guy who wrote the book on punk rock bass playing. You know, he's the original. There's nobody ever going to match him or be better than him stylistically, you know, playing wise. So when I got into the band, I didn't look at it as I'm replacing Dee Dee. I looked at it as I got hired to do a job and I'm going to do my absolute best.
Yeah.
You know, I was coming right out of the military into the Ramones. I was in the Marine Corps actually when I auditioned. So
that's
I was
crazy.
Very mission oriented and very focused. So, you know, the last few times I had seen the Ramones, they weren't very good. You know, they had really kind of were fading.
Okay.
And Dee Dee was, you know, trying to launch a rap career. You know, it was really like kind of sad the last time I went to see them.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got the audition, in my mind, I wanted to make them exciting like they were when I first saw them.
Okay.
You know, like, I was like, I'm going to get on stage and I'm just going to go for it, you know? And from years of playing in heavy metal bands and, you know, banging my head and thrashing and stuff, I was always very physical on stage playing heavy metal. So when I got into the Ramones, I brought that aggressive stage presence and, you know, to the band.
Yeah.
And kind of reignited the spark for Johnny and Joey also, because I think once they saw, well, they actually told me and have said it in interviews that once they saw what I was doing, they were like, oh, we better step it up a little bit here. We can't let the new guy outshine us, you know? So,
and you also did a lot of singing, vocals.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Joey, I got in the band, Joey was already on the road singing for 15 years. And, you know, Joey struggled with alcohol and drugs for a while, you know. He wasn't kind to himself, you know. Mm-hmm. So when I came in, he actually, you know, I was always amazed at, like, how little ego he had. Like, instead of him getting upset about me, about Johnny saying, you know, CJ should sing this, CJ should sing that, Joey looked at it as, oh, yeah, I can take a break. Okay. Like, and he would tell me, yeah, you should sing that song. You should sing, I like the way you sing that, you know.
Wow.
So, because Joey didn't come to rehearsals, so I would sing all the songs at rehearsals.
Ah, okay.
You know, when we went in to record the records, I sang all the scratch vocal tracks. I sang all the new songs at the rehearsals. I sang everything. So I took it on as my job to help the band out. Okay. But of course, it turned into me singing more and more songs with the band until I was singing 4 or 5 songs a night.
Wow, I didn't know that, that he didn't show up to the rehearsals.
Did he struggle? Joey was very fragile. He was very fragile. His health was fragile. You know, he was never, very healthy from when he was young. To save his voice, he wouldn't come to practice. And, you know, he took a lot of singing lessons. And it took a lot to keep Joey going, you know. Yeah. Our tour manager, Monty Melnick, was basically Joey's kind of personal assistant when we were on the road, mm-hmm. besides being the tour manager.
What kind of mood was there in the band when you started? were there friends or
it was strange.
Strange?
Yeah, it was strange. Oh. There was a lot of internal conflict for years within the band. Mm-hmm. You know, there was struggles over, you know, girls and drugs and alcohol problems. And there was always a lot of internal conflict in the band. So the van was often quiet. Yeah, okay. Johnny and Joey only talked when they had to as a matter of business. I learned to, you know, I learned to just kind of sit back and be quiet. But, you know, I always loved to read and I listened to music constantly. So I sat in the back row in the van with my Walkman on. I had a Walkman and brought my tapes on the road with me. And I would read. I'm a voracious reader. I would read sometimes 2 or 3 books in a tour.
So you sat there listening to Iron Maiden songs in the back
Of the course. Bus. Of course. And everything else. I mean, you know, by the time I got into the Ramones, you know, I was listening to just about everything. It was funny, sometimes at soundcheck, I'd break out some Iron Maiden riffs, you know, like I just start playing some, like Rime of the Ancient Mariner or something. And once in a while, Mark would jump in and play a little something behind it. But yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
So nice. I think I'll have to play the song ending here, Prodigal Son.
All right.
Let's just listen.
All the way up to the sweet notes and the little flare on the cymbal. I mean, that song is just great, beginning to end.
Yeah, and all the memories just comes back when you hear it again.
Yep. From those that years. Song, in particular, reminds me of when I was a teenager. There was a closed down psychiatric building. It was the tallest building on Long Island.
Okay.
It was many stories. And it was, you know, just all torn up. But we used to sneak in there at night and we would climb all the way up to the top of the roof. And from the roof, you could see the lights of New York City. You could see everything. And we were, you know, we were a fair ways away from the city. But on clear nights, it was unreal. And we would drag, you know, we would drag a keg of beer up there or a couple of cases of beer, and we'd get up there and smoke weed and drink beer. And one night we were sitting up there, and like I said, I like to read and stuff, you know what I mean? I love any stories about the constellations in the sky, and we were up on the crown drinking beer, smoking weed, and we were listening to Prodigal Son. And I was looking up, and the constellation of the seven sisters, the Pleiades,
yeah,
was very, very bright in the sky, like you could really see it. And I was telling my buddies about, you know, the story about the seven sisters from Greek mythology and everything, and Prodigal Son was playing in the background. And it was one of those moments where you feel like you're exactly where you should be doing what you should be doing in your life. Like you recognize it as like a really like special moment. And that's, so that memory always jumps into my mind whenever I listen to Prodigal Son. It's just up there on top, like on top of the world, just staring up at the stars and listening to that song in the background, smoking pot, drinking beer with my friends. It's like such a great memory from my teen years. Excuse me, from my teen years.
Oh shit, that's so beautiful, and I think it must be the most beautiful ending of an episode ever. So CJ,
all right,
CJ, thank you so much for joining me, and yeah, I just hope you just spend more time with your family and make more music, of course.
absolutely, thanks for having me on, talk about one of my favorite bands, Up the Irons.
Gammal Maiden med Torkel Torsvik, en podcast fra Radio Rock.